Welcome to the Capital News. I am your host, Alex Kritis. Today is February 25th, 2020. Thank you so much for joining me. Title of today's podcast is Bubble Bursting. And of course, that is a question, as so many of our titles are. They do come in a form of a question. Because we don't know everything, we like to ask questions. We like to get the audience thinking. It's important to ask these types of questions in the political sphere, in the economic and financial investment sphere, everything, because it's all connected in one form or another. But what we have been witnessing for several months has been undoubtedly a large melt-up in global equities, with a particular emphasis here in the United States. And is this bubble, is this melt-up simply running out of steam? Is this your typical correction? Now, of course, in this era of 24/7 media, where everybody has social media accounts, everybody wants to be first to report, everybody wants to get everything first, not necessarily right, but they want to be first, everything is hyped up. This is sort of just your run-of-the-mill correction. So to some degree, this should have been expected. The question is it going to turn into something bigger? Hence the question, hence the title of today's podcast, Bubble Bursting. Because this is a process. This is not going to be a day event. This is not going to be a week's event. This is going to take a good amount of time to unravel. Now, we could see another massive sell-off like we did in the fourth quarter of 2018, and you see that type of big sell-off, that 20% sell-off over the course of a month. That's quite possible. Am I saying that's going to happen? No, I'm not, because I don't know when it's going to happen. It will, eventually. All bubbles burst. All parties come to an end. No matter what these central banks continue to do, no matter what federal governments continue to do in the order of fiscal stimulus, no matter what politician, no matter how charismatic he or she may be, it's not going to make a difference, because you can only defy the law of economics for so long. And to some degree, I don't know if this is the best wording to use, but you got to give credit where credit is due, I guess, in this regard. And these fraudsters, these crackheads, these idiots, who we call our leaders or our monetary authorities, have been able to kick this can down the road a lot further than what I had thought, what I had anticipated. Which is not a good thing, by the way, because it only makes the day of reckoning that much worse. It just makes the correction, the bust, the other side of this boom, that much deeper, that much more severe. Is this going to be the end in sight now, with the potential bubble bursting? And again, this is the everything bubble. This isn't just the subprime housing market bubble. This is not just a commercial real estate bubble. This is not just a consumer credit bubble. This is not just a corporate balance sheet junk bond bubble. It's an everything bubble. And then you got to throw in the federal government with trillion-dollar deficits. And you got to throw in central banks themselves, with how they have expanded their balance sheets. Now we have the Federal Reserve that's going to be meeting for the Federal Open Market Committee next month. I believe that's in the middle of March, the 16th, 17th, 18th, somewhere around there. So we're only a couple weeks away from that meeting and that determination as to what they're going to do with interest rates. Anybody want to take a guess as to what these idiots might do? I know what the markets want them to do. They want them to cut interest rates, of course, because somehow printing money is going to be a cure-all. A cure-all. I don't think that's going to work. Could this finally be the moment where central banks attempt to come to the rescue once again, cutting interest rates, expanding their balance sheet, getting involved with overnight lending, the repo market, what have you, and then it's just not work? Is this finally it? Is this finally the point where diminishing marginal returns has finally kicked in, where it's obvious? And that's important to note that, because it has kicked in a while ago, in my opinion, and in my analysis. The question is, the markets are, you know, they're psychologically driven. We're human beings. We're emotional. It's not always about logic and reason. But now, is it going to be so in your face that everybody's going to wake up? Is this aha moment? Oh, my goodness. We've been taken on a ride for the past decade. It's been good for a lot of people who have stayed invested, who have bought the dips, and have ridden every single one of them to higher highs. Of course, depending on the timing of it, it might take a little bit longer to get there, but you got there. But you got there to all-time highs, slowly but surely, thanks to none other than central banks who had your back, because there could be no massive sell-off. But has diminishing marginal returns finally kicked in where it is obvious to everybody? Because now we are dealing with an event, but it's not man-made. At least I hope it's not man-made. Of course, I'm talking about the coronavirus, COVID-19. Something that came out of the woodwork that markets and people and governments were not anticipating. They were not expecting this type of shock. Markets were not expecting this type of shock. And again, it is on both sides of the ledger. It is a supply shock, and it is a demand shock. It is both. Because the arguments are out there floating around like it is and has been common for the past decade. It's always an argument. What are we going to have? Is it going to be inflation or is it going to be deflation? Like I always say here, you can have both. What sector of the economy are you talking about? What service are you talking about? What product are you talking about? Because all else equal, if you just had a supply shock, you'd say, well, yeah, of course there's going to be some sort of price inflation. Yeah, of course. Because the demand is still there, but the supply isn't. So of course prices are going to go higher. But we have a demand shock here too. So is that going to be counterbalancing? Is that going to negate the effects that we otherwise would have witnessed if this was simply a supply shock? You get what I'm saying? It can be both. So it again goes back to what are you talking about specifically? What service, what sector of the economy, what product or good are you noting? And then you're just going to have to do your analysis as to what that might be. But it can be both. Now, we've been talking here for the past few weeks about COVID-19. We've also been talking a little bit about the locust outbreak, which I also think is somewhat important. Maybe not so much going to have a downstream effect here in the United States, like COVID-19 most definitely has and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. But in regards to a lot of the other issues that we have been discussing, I do think the locust outbreak to some extent is worth mentioning here, even if it is on a daily basis, because there are daily updates taking place, because now we have these swarms that are now making their way in further into Africa. Remember, it started on the eastern side of Africa, the Horn of Africa, if you will, Somalia, Ethiopia. And because those governments are fractured, because there's a lot of warfare taking place, especially in Somalia, these government officials were unable to get this outbreak of locusts under control. Given the other climatic conditions that exist, they're able to survive and thrive. And they are continuing to make their way further and further into Africa. They're now making their way into Sudan. They're also now making their way into the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which has not seen a locust outbreak since 1944. So are they going to be prepared for this? Are they going to be able to stop it in its tracks? Because the further this thing goes, the worse it's going to be. And don't forget, this is just simply like the first generation of locusts right now from this first swarm here. The second generation is coming to maturity, if you will, back in Ethiopia, back in Somalia. So round two is coming. Round two is coming. They are decimating crops. They're decimating fields. They're decimating pastures, which has an effect on livestock. So this is a double whammy, basically a triple whammy, because a lot of these people in these countries, unfortunately, live in poverty, have to deal with starvation on a regular basis before the locust outbreak. Now you add this on top of it, and it's just one thing after the next. These locusts are also making their way into Saudi Arabia, which we talked about. They're also making their way into Bahrain. They're slightly in India. They're in Pakistan, which I do believe has declared it a national emergency. And they're making their way into China. And now you have to add on top of this, COVID-19. So there are a lot of problems. And what I'm getting at here in the context of the inflation side of things is if you have these crops that are decimated. And this is the first round. If farmers are unable to plant, or if they do have a window of opportunity to plant them, what's going to happen with the next round of locusts if they don't get under control? So even if they are lucky enough to get a second harvest, will the locusts wipe them out before they're able to take their crop? So now you could really see food inflation start to pick up in these countries around the rest of the world, because we have some inflation numbers out of Lebanon. And the reason, again, I want to bring up Lebanon is because they are one of the countries who are part of the global protests, who are demanding change. Well, their inflation rate is now a little north of 10%. Their inflation rate now is a little north of 10%. I believe one of the main drivers, one of the main causes of a lot of these global protests, and I've stated it here all the time, is the fact that people are sick and tired of being sick and tired because just a little bit of a pickup in the cost of living, whether it's a 5% tax on fuel or a 10% increase on a bus fare or to ride the metro or whatever the case may be, it's enough. It's enough. And when we talked recently about the dollar doom loop, this is what's feeding into it. You're starting to see and understand how this is all interconnected. Because Lebanon has a lot of debt that is coming due, and they are in discussions with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, to basically give a big haircut to their bondholders as well. It's not going to be good, folks. Remember, one man's debt is another man's asset. So this is not a zero-sum game here. This somebody loses. Okay, these things don't just balance out and everybody's fine. Everybody goes back home and, you know, goes to bed, no problems. No, that's not how it works. And we're going to talk here about some domestic politics because there was a Democratic presidential debate this evening. And of course, all the free stuff comes up. Debt forgiveness, student debt, this is free, that's free. Somebody's got to pay for it. It's not a zero-sum game. We'll get to that. Coronavirus. Couple big points today, and we're going to get to market performance because there was a continuation on the sell side of things today. But we have more cases coming out of Iran. We actually have the deputy health minister who has contracted the virus just after a day ago. Oh, we have it under control. It's really just being hyped and overplayed. No big deal. Nope, this guy, the deputy health minister in Iran, has contracted COVID-19. We have a couple confirmed cases in Austria, cases in Croatia, cases in Spain. Now we have confirmed cases in Brazil. South Korea continues to increase. Confirmed cases, I do believe, in Israel, and a confirmed case in Switzerland. So this is far from being contained. It is far from over. Yes, we can still say it's being hyped up. I don't believe that is the case, because today, finally, we got a little bit of leadership, a little bit of honesty from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control here in the United States, saying it's not a question of if, but when we see an outbreak of COVID-19 here in the United States of America. People are still talking about vaccines. That's fine to talk about vaccines. They're not a light switch. You don't flip them and here they are. It's going to take a year to 18 months, if not longer, for there to be a viable vaccine that is ready for global distribution. So it's not even close. We continue to see factories remain shuttered. We continue to have governments closing down schools and for longer periods than originally stated. Prime example was Hong Kong, which we discussed yesterday. Question about the Olympics taking place in Japan this summer. What are they going to do? Are they going to cancel the Olympics? I think they probably will. That's my guess. I obviously have no inside information. I hope the Olympics do take place. That's still several months down the road. But we know with the incubation period of this virus, are you really going to risk having all the nations of the world basically descending into Japan, which is a highly, very densely populated country to begin with, in a virus that seems to be very contagious? I just don't think that's a good idea. Because say for the sake of example, we discussed this yesterday, yeah, they got things under control, and maybe it's truly eradicated in Japan by the time of the Olympics. Well, that might not be so for other countries around the world who are going to be flying in to Japan. So does Japan want to go through round two of this? Do other countries want to risk spreading it to other people who have just successfully gotten rid of it, if that's the case? See what I'm getting at? This is far from being over. And we know beyond a doubt, with the epicenter of this being in China, that the data that we have received from China thus far is an absolute lie. There's no truth to it. None. Those numbers are so underreported, it's not even funny. I wish I could give you a more accurate number, but I don't know. I'm not an epidemiologist. We've obviously discussed what some epidemiologists think. I watched an interesting interview last night by Steve Bannon. He was interviewed by Simone Gao, G-A-O. You can check that out. Steve Bannon, Simone Gao, her last name, G-A-O. You can find it on YouTube. It's about an hour or so long. Very informative, what's going on. Steve Bannon, you might like him, you might dislike him, but the man is in the know. He does a lot of studying. He does a lot of reading. He has a lot of connections. I suggest you take the time to listen to it, because he was talking about some people that he's been listening to and who he's been talking with in regards to virology, microbiology, epidemiology, as to what this thing can turn into. And he gave a staggering number, but it's consistent with what we've been discussing here too from some of the sources that I've been coming across. By May of this year, if this virus is not adequately contained, we could be talking about 1 billion people who have been infected by COVID-19. 1 billion people by May. That's only a few months away. That's just ridiculous. But it's quite possible, because the Harvard epidemiologist, who we've been discussing here for the past couple of weeks, has noted that this thing could infect 40 to 70% of the entire planet. Okay? So 1 billion is a lot less than 40, 50, 60, 70%. So if you were to somewhat split the difference and say 50% in a planet that has 7.5 billion people, you're talking over 3 billion people that could potentially be infected with this if this thing is not contained. There is no vaccine. Again, that is at least a year away. Now, of course, we're not being told the truth by the Chinese. I don't think we're being told the full truth by the World Health Organization. I don't think we're being told the full truth by the CDC, any other government for that matter, especially ours here in the United States as well, because our president and administration is more concerned with the stock market performance as opposed to making sure this thing is contained. That's a sad state of affairs. We'll see what happens. But this is not going away anytime soon. Is the bubble bursting? Is reality sinking in? All these questions are pertinent to ask at this time. Or is it simply just an exhaustion of everything, finally coming to a head, finally running out of steam? That diminishing marginal returns across the board in global equity markets and global bond markets have just said, enough is enough, man. We cannot take it anymore. We cannot continue to be shot up with this adrenaline, with this heroin, with this crack. We cannot take it anymore. And now, maybe coincidentally, there just happens to be the coronavirus taking place, which is a convenient excuse to justify the sell-off. And again, this is run-of-the-mill. The media wants to make it seem like it's the worst thing ever, but this is only a handful of percentage points over the course of 3 days. It's not that big of a deal at this juncture, but it could be. But it could be, and that's why we asked the question. Is reality sinking in? Is this bubble bursting? Because it will. It's just a matter of time. And that's why I always tell you to stay diversified and stay vigilant, because I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know when it's going to be. But when you look further under the hood and you start to look at some of the bond spreads, on the yield spreads, especially when it comes to the junk bonds or bonds that are close to junk, and in particular the energy sector, which we've been warning about here for weeks, if not months, they're getting a lot closer to triple C rated junk. So the cracks in the foundation are already here. Now it's just a question of the ripple effect. How far And how quickly does it start to infect, if you will, the various sectors of this economy? Because we are awash in debt. That debt needs to be serviced. And if you're not producing something, and if you can't sell it, you have a problem. And the only way that you're going to shore up some of your cash flow in this type of situation is to start cutting hours, which we've already been seeing a slowdown in hours. And we say all the time here that hours leads bodies. You cut hours before you start laying people off. But if you're in this type of supply squeeze and demand squeeze, you're going to start seeing people getting laid off. And then the problems are just going to create another doom loop, if you will. Because once again, we have the president out there talking about the stock market. We have the president once again out there talking about the coronavirus is going to be contained. Everything's going to be okay. It'll pass in a couple months. He doesn't know this. Okay? I'm sick and tired of all of the BS from everybody. I just want some leadership. I just want some straight shooter. That's all we're asking for here. Just a little bit of truth, a little bit of honesty. Get people prepared. Have them understand the situation, what they're going to do, because the CDC is expecting this thing to change the lifestyle of people in this country like it has in China, like it has in South Korea and elsewhere. Putting people under quarantine, shutting down schools, shutting down businesses, all this type of stuff. Have a plan in place. Lead. Lead. You're supposed to be a different type of politician. Act like it. Be that different type of politician. Be that different type of leader that this country was looking for and is continuing to look for. Don't worry about your precious, stupid stock market. It's a bubble. You knew it was a bubble 4 years ago. Now you want it to be your stock market in your bubble, but you don't want to call it that. Lives are literally on the line, and all this guy can think about is getting his message out when it comes to the stock market. Send Larry Kudlow out there yesterday and today to say everything's fine, go ahead and buy stocks. Remember, he said the stock market's looking good yesterday, the president tweeted out. Well, you lost another 3% today if you went in and bought with both hands because you thought everything was going to be okay. Go get your money back. Go get it back. See if he gives it to you. Don't think that's going to be the case. This is not his concern, what the stock market does. What is his concern is a health pandemic. That's his concern. That's his concern. That's a legitimate cause for government. To keep the people in this country safe and as healthy as possible from these types of outbreaks and situations. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average continued its decline, giving back nearly another 900 points for the day, losing 3.15% for the day. The S&P 500 gave back 98 points, losing another 3 percentage points for the day. The NASDAQ 100 gave back 245, down 2.7%. At the time of this podcast, we have the Japanese markets down 200 points, almost 1% for the day. Across Europe, down 2, almost 3%, depending on the index. No end in sight. Now, we'll see, of course, what happens tomorrow. Are we going to get some sort of relief rally, some sort of dead cat bounce here in the United States and Europe? Time will tell. This is a very fluid situation with different cases being reported on an hour-by-hour basis in those countries that I just stated. Iran, Austria, Croatia, Spain, now in South America, in Brazil, South Korea, the cases keep going up. Israel, a confirmed case in Switzerland as well. No end in sight. Commodity space. We have crude, WTI trading at about $50 even a barrel. Brent trading at about $55 even per barrel. Natural gas at $1.84 per million British thermal units. Gold and silver surprisingly took a little bit of a hit today. Perhaps some sort of liquidation, some profit taking perhaps. But nonetheless, gold is trading at $1,642 an ounce. Silver at $18.10. Per ounce. I want to talk a little bit more about the bond market because we talked about this yesterday, that this is really where you have to pay attention because the bond market is so much larger than the stock market. And the stock market is going to start taking, I think, a lot of its cues from the bond market because it's just going to have to. I mean, this is, it's what it's been doing for the past decade, really. Now, of course, over the past maybe year or so, maybe not even, but really in this past melt-up phase, several months, you're starting to see that big divergence, and we've talked about this, between how the bond market is performing and how the stock market is performing. We said they both can't be right because the stock market is saying, okay, everything's going to be okay. There's a lot of growth in the future. Everything's fine. We know that's not the case. And the bond market is usually quicker to sniff that out. And so we have yields making record lows. We have the U.S. 10-year yielding 1.35%. 1.35%. And this is without any further Federal Reserve rate cuts. This is the 10-year doing it all by its lonesome. 1.35%. Now, of course, that's a little bit further out there on the yield curve, of course, but you get what I'm saying. Because we have the U.S. one month, a T-bill, yielding 1.59%. Now, when we're going to be looking at the yield curve, when it comes to any type of inversion, what we really want to focus on, again, is the 10-year versus the 3-month and the 10-year versus the 2-year. Well, let's take a look at the 3-month, shall we? It is yielding 1.54%. So it is yielding a higher level than is the U.S. 10-year. So we continue to see a yield curve inversion on the 3-month 10-year Treasury. And again, if you don't understand that, we've done previous podcasts on that. But more conveniently, you can go to our website, thecapitalnews.com, and check out our Capital Economics presentation on the yield curve when we do analysis on both the 10-year versus 3-month and the 10-year versus the 2-year. So check those out if you're looking for more background information on what that actually means, because they're forward-looking indicators. And what it tells us is that a recession is on the horizon. It's not immediate. There's usually a lag factor. From the first inversion, we've seen inversions months and months ago. And when you look at that in conjunction with a whole bunch of other data that we discuss here all the time, when you start putting that economic puzzle together, you start to see the picture that much more vivid. And you understand what we're looking at. That's why I've been warning that this is a bubble, that it will burst, but I have no idea what day, what time that's going to take place. Stay diversified and stay vigilant, right? Okay, what about the 30-year? Well, we're making more record lows on the 30-year long bond as well, 1.81%. So give Uncle Sam your money for 30 years, you're getting 1.81%. No, thank you. Now, that's for the yield. Now, if somebody's chasing a capital gain, because remember, yields and prices are inversely related, so if that yield continues to go south, the price goes north. So if you're looking to capitalize with a capital gain on those bonds, you might get away with it. You might get away with it. But I'm telling you, the lower these rates go, the higher they can spike. So now your risk reward is really starting to get a little bit precarious here. Because typically, at least the conventional thinking when it comes to bonds is people are looking for that yield. They're looking for that safety, that steady cash flow, that coupon coming in every 6 months. Now, a lot of people might be treating bonds as, no, we're just going to look at it for a capital gain. I don't care what it's yielding because I think interest rates are going to go lower, so I just want to capitalize on the capital gain of the price appreciation of that bond. That might be a good strategy. That might pay off for you. The long bond, I think, did gain about 20% last year. So that can continue. And I have no doubt in my mind, at least for the foreseeable future, rates will head lower. The Federal Reserve is likely to cut rates or to continue to embark on quantitative easing, which again is de facto interest rate cuts after so much money has been thrown back into the system. Just like quantitative tightening, same effect. It might not be an official rate hike with quantitative tightening, but after so much money has been pulled out of the system, it has the same effect as an interest rate hike. So the same thing just in reverse now with quantitative easing. So it's going to be interesting to see what the Federal Reserve does next week because you already have markets pricing in a couple rate cuts this year. Doesn't mean it has to be next month, but if this thing continues to accelerate, COVID-19, well, then they might say, well, you know, we shot from the hip a few months ago when it came to the trade war and all that uncertainty and all that BS. We don't really know what we're doing. We've never done this before as justification for cutting interest rates, but we're going to do it. we're going to do it. And they did. So are they going to use COVID-19 as a convenient excuse to justify their rationale for cutting interest rates again or for staying in the overnight repo market for longer than what they anticipated? We were thinking about April, but now, what's another couple months, right? Amongst friends, who cares? It was supposed to be a one-off back in September. Temporary, you know. Then it was October. Then it was the end of December. Then it was the end of January. Then it said, we can't just keep doing this. Let's just say till the end of April, right? What are they going to tell us next month? Because it's a mixed bag, of course, depending on what idiot comes out and gives a speech or gives an interview from the Federal Reserve. There's no common theme amongst them, which I think is disastrous because of the amount of power that they wield when these idiots come out and talk as to what the markets are going to do. It's too much power for anybody to have, which is why they shouldn't have it. And if you do have that kind of power, you shouldn't be talking about it, especially out of line. At least have a consistent theme and message from everybody on board. That's why I don't like the President of the United States talking about it. He has too much power. He moves markets. Not supposed to be that way. The supply and demand of goods is supposed to be what determines that. Not what somebody says, not by decree, but by markets doing what they are supposed to do. Find fair market value. I don't think I'm asking for too much. But that's some of the market performance. Yes, pay attention to the stock market and what it's doing. But pay attention to the bond market, too, because if the bond market is so much bigger than the stock market, it's not even funny. And if we start to see any type of sharp increase in yield, I mean, we saw what that did in November and in December of 2018, when the Federal Reserve started to continued their path of increases in interest rates. The economy, the stock market said, no, we can't take it. We can't do it. Particularly the stock market. The stock market said we can't take it. We can't take yields at 2.2%, 2.25%, 2.5%. Couldn't even take it. The greatest economy ever and the stock market couldn't take 2.5%. Unbelievable. Unless you pay attention to the capital news and you understand what's really going on. So that's some of the market news. It's been a continuation because that's what we've been witnessing. For several months, it was a continuation of the melt-up. Now, over the past few days, we're seeing a reversal. We're seeing some sort of correction. The question is this just your run-of-the-mill correction, or is this something that is truly the beginning of the bubble bursting? Now, onto the political side of things, and we'll wrap this up. The Democrats debated this evening in South Carolina. Seven candidates on the stage. I imagine after the South Carolina primary this weekend, a couple of these Democratic contenders for the presidency will drop out. Now, Tom Steyer is a billionaire. If he wants to continue to fund himself, he can do so through Super Tuesday. I mean, it's only going to be a few days after. Maybe he says, well, what the hell? I'll just stick around for a few more days, see what happens. Amy Klobuchar, she might have the same attitude. Because she's not going to win South Carolina. She's not going to come in first, second, or third. So what is she thinking? Maybe carry some last minute momentum. Maybe get something, some sort of head nod from somebody. I don't know. And it's only a few days away, so we'll hang on for Super Tuesday also. Elizabeth Warren. She hasn't won anything either. She hasn't placed that well in any of these contests. She's probably not going to place that well in South Carolina either. Because you have Joe Biden, who is expected to win. You have Bernie Sanders, who's nipping at his heels in second. And you have Tom Steyer, who has a relationship with the African-American community, so they say. And he spent a lot of time and money and resources in South Carolina. So he might have a little bit of an opportunity to steal some votes. And we still know that Mayor Michael Bloomberg is not on the ballot in South Carolina. He's betting his race on Super Tuesday and onward. He was not on the ballot in Iowa, in New Hampshire, in Nevada, or in South Carolina this weekend. So he's not even on there, but we know he's going to continue because he has the money to do so. And his performance on the debate stage was not a disaster like it was a week ago. So he got some redemption points. He will be on CNN tomorrow evening on a town hall, so it'll be a little bit more informal, a little bit more interactive with a moderator and with the audience. So we'll see how he handles himself there. So he can get some bonus points on that town hall if he can sort of answer some more questions more fully, because we know how these debates operate, especially when there's several candidates up there. They only have a minute and 15 seconds or whatever it is to answer a question. They have to think on their feet sometimes, you know, and they have a 30-second, 45-second rebuttal. You're really not going to get a full-throated, heartfelt answer from a lot of these candidates in such a short amount of time, especially from somebody like Bloomberg, who he's not really a professional debater. I mean, he had, you know, 12 years as mayor, but he's not really a professional politician. Most of his time has been spent in the philanthropic areas of the economy or in the economy itself through being a businessman, which led to him having $60 billion. So it's not his forte. His team explains this. He explains this himself. We know this. And then he's up against candidates who they either debate for a living because they're congressmen or senators, politicians, professional politicians, and they've been on the campaign trail for a year. So they've been on the debate stage. So they, you know, they have their sea legs, if you will. But he didn't shoot himself in the foot again. So he still has a prayer, and we'll see how he performs in Super Tuesday. But some of the haymakers were thrown once again. The knives came out again, focused on primarily Bernie Sanders, because he is the front runner, and still, but to a lesser degree, Michael Bloomberg. I don't think any of the shots that were thrown at either men really landed. I don't think this debate is going to have any material effect on what takes place in the South Carolina primary. I do think Elizabeth Warren scored some good points last week in Nevada. I think she already got her jolt from it. She tried to go down that path again with Bloomberg. And you have to understand that you know that Bloomberg's going to be prepared this time for those attacks. So he's going to have an answer. He's going to have a defense for it, whether it's head on or whether it's pivot and go to something else. You have to be in anticipation of that. So she went down that path, and it was not as effective as it was last week, because you could hear the crowd, and I'm sure some of this was just Bloomberg's people in general, but they knew when this was their cue to sort of stand up for Bloomberg and start booing Elizabeth Warren if and when she brought this up. And that has an effect, especially if the crowd is not basically told by the moderators to remain quiet, no laughing, no cheering, no booing, no applauding. Well, they weren't told that. They were allowed to be involved. And so when Elizabeth Warren asked those questions again, trying to hit Bloomberg on those same questions with the NDAs and all that crap, people started to boo. And you could see the effect that it shielded Bloomberg from the damage that it did a week ago. Again, when you go after Bernie Sanders, he pivots. He doesn't care, man. He's got a message and he's going to stick to it. You can say whatever you want. Maybe he'll answer some of it. Maybe he'll take you down another path and then circle around and come back to it. But you're just not going to land that many blows on Bernie Sanders. Rightly or wrongly, that's just how the man operates. It's not his first rodeo. So we're going to find out this weekend. The field will narrow down, thank goodness, over the coming, well, about basically next 10 days after Super Tuesday. You're probably only going to have about 3 or 4 candidates left, if that. I imagine Steyer will be gone. I imagine Klobuchar will be gone. Depending on how badly Buttigieg, you know, fares in South Carolina in Super Tuesday, he's going to have to read the writing on the wall. Not his time yet. And for all intents and purposes, even Elizabeth Warren, I mean, she hasn't won anything. She's not going to win in South Carolina. She's probably not going to place well, like I previously said. So she's going to have to really outperform in Super Tuesday to have a prayer. Otherwise, you're talking about Biden, Bernie, and Bloomberg. That's it. 3 old white guys on the Democratic ticket. Who would have thunk that one? I mean, I don't care. But the Democratic Party might, because they're all about, you know, what do they call it? I can't even remember what they call it. Gender identity politics is what they call it. The stupidity of it. My brain doesn't even want to put it in its memory bank. It's how stupid these people are with this crap. Identity politics. Identity politics. Who cares? What's the content of their character? How's the soundness and logic and reasoning of their policies. That's what I'm interested in. I don't care if they're black. I don't care if they're white. I don't care if it's a man or a woman. What are your policies? What's the content of your character? That's what I'm concerned with. Are you going to be an effective executive? Because that's what it is. You're not a legislator if you're running for president. You're an executive. And that's how Bloomberg is attempting to draw that distinction between him and the other candidates. I am an executive. I know how to run businesses. I know how to run charities. I ran a city. I'm not here to be a legislator. I'm here to be the calm, cool, collected, stable hand in the White House that can cut some of the red tape, that can bring people together, and he might just be able to do that. Maybe. Maybe. He's got a long way to go. It's going to be an uphill battle. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. He got into the race late. He got his butt handed to him last week on the debate stage. But there is a lot of time between now and the nomination process. A lot of time between now and the general election in November. But I do think that argument coming from Bloomberg can resonate with people, that he is the calm, stable hand and that he can work with both Republicans and Democrats because he has. Yes, I have been a Republican. Yes, I have been an independent. Yes, I have been a Democrat. He was attacked today on the stage again by Elizabeth Warren, saying that he was giving money back in 2016 to a South Carolina senator, Lindsey Graham. Well, he should have said, Bloomberg, he should have responded, you know what? I'm not running to be the president of the Democratic Party. I'm running to be the president of the United States. So it might not be a bad thing if I am able to reach across the line, the party divide, no matter how great it might be at current times. I have the ability to do it because I have funded Republicans. I have funded Democrats. I can get things done because right now we have an administration that does very little when it comes to reaching across the aisle to get things done. And likewise, the Democrats don't reach across the aisle to get much done either. Plenty of blame to go around. So I think that would be a strong response from him. See, here's the problem. I'm not running to be the president of the Democratic Party. I'm running to be the president of the United States. And I can work with both parties because I have, and I can do it again. And on top of that, I have the record. I have the experience. My demeanor is calm and stable. I'm not chaotic. I want to surround myself with people smarter than me. Donald Trump thinks he is always the smartest person in the room. That's a big difference. And you can play that up all day long. And I think Bloomberg has the ability to do it. But I, like I said yesterday, do not discount Bernie Sanders. Don't say he's out of here. Don't say that he can't do it because he can, because that's exactly what people said about Donald Trump 4 years ago. There's no way. Remember the Democrats? Oh yeah, we want Donald Trump to be the nominee. Bring him on. Absolutely. This is going to be a piece of cake. Well, who's sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? So to my conservative Republican friends out there, do not be blinded by this, because this is what happened 4 years ago with your guy, and now he's the president. So don't be surprised if Bernie Sanders gets the nomination and somehow pulls this thing off in November. Long way to go, but do not be surprised, because we talked about some of his arguments here yesterday, and as ridiculous as they're going to resonate with a lot of people in this country. We saw it 4 years ago when he was running against Hillary. We're seeing it again today. And a lot of those problems have persisted, and a lot of them have gotten even worse. So he's carrying even more water this time. As ludicrous as a lot of them are to their core, they are arguments that resonate. And it becomes emotional. And that's Trump's strength. It's not his logic. It's not his reasoning. It's not his policy prescriptions or his command of policy, because he has none. It's not his ideal. It's not his ideas, because he's not an ideologue. He's transactional. But he makes things emotional. There's an emotional connection with him and his supporters. Same is true with Bernie Sanders. So you're going to fight fire with fire? You better be careful, is all I'm saying. It's one end of the other spectrum. There's a lot of overlap between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. I told you 2020 was going to be interesting. A month ago, we said it was only January. Now it's February. My goodness. Buckle up. Stay diversified, stay vigilant, and stay with the Capital News. I am Alex Kritis. Godspeed.